Good evening. Hello, friends. Welcome. I'm Rick Griffiths. I'm Associate Dean of the faculty here. And I have the honor of introducing Professor Diane Ravitch, who is the 2008 John J. McCloy Professor of American Institutions. The McCloy Professorship was established by the college in 1983 to honor John J. McCloy and his outstanding career of service and accomplishment in American politics and international diplomacy. We have the privilege this year of welcoming Professor Diane Ravitch, Research Professor of Education at New York University and Senior Fellow at the Hoover and Brookings Institutions. And that extraordinary triangulation of posts suggests the respect and influence Professor Ravitch enjoys in the many sides of current debates on education. A native of Houston and a graduate of the Houston Public Schools, she was graduated from Wellesley and received her doctorate from Columbia. From 1991 to 1993, she served as Assistant Secretary of Education in the administration of President George H.W. Bush, in which capacity she presided over the Office of Educational Research and Improvement in the Department of Education and led the federal effort to promote the creation of state and national academic standards. From 1997 to 2004, she served on the National Assessment Governing Board, and from 1995 to 2005, she held the Brown Chair in Education Studies at the Brookings Institution and edited the Brookings Papers on Educational Policy. She's authored 8 influential books, including most recently, Left Back, A Century of Battles Over School Reform in 2000, and The Language Police, How Pressure Groups Restrict What Students Learn in 2003. She's edited 14 books and written more than 400 articles and reviews for scholarly and general audiences. And of the edited volumes, most recent is The English Reader, What Every Literate Person Needs to Know, 2006, co-edited with her son Michael Ravitch. Forgotten Heroes of American Education, The Great Tradition of Teaching Teachers. And Beyond Basics, Achieving a Liberal Education for All Children, 2007. The list of awards and other honorifics would consume the evening. Professor Ravitch is known for the rare capacity to speak to all camps without being beholden to any of them. As mentioned, she is a fellow of both the Brookings and Hoover institutions and served under both the first President Bush and the only President Clinton, and has received honorary doctorates from both Williams and, in 1986, Amherst. And there's a trace of prophecy in the citation of that honorary degree of 22 years ago. You teach not only prospective teachers, but also government departments, state and federal commissions, and other professional educators. Little did we know, perhaps you knew. Join us now in welcoming back to Amherst our distinguished McCloy professor, Dr. Diane Ravitch, who will speak on school reform. Are we making progress?
Thank you very much, Professor Griffiths, and good evening, everyone. I'm very happy to be back at Amherst. I visited this wonderful campus many times when my son Joe was a student. He graduated in 1984, and I had the honor to be the class day speaker at his graduation. Joe loved the college. It was here that he formed his closest friendship, and to this day, his best buddies are the people that he met almost 25 years ago at Amherst. He majored in Russian, and he had the amazing opportunity to spend a semester in Moscow during the Cold War, and Amherst changed his life, for which he'll be forever grateful. For my part, I've been studying and writing about American schools now to 40 years. When I was in graduate school and studying the history of American education, I realized one day that there has been a crisis in American education in every decade of the 20th century. I eventually concluded that in a nation with such a decentralized system of education, 50 state boards of education, and now 15,000 school districts, at the end of World War II there were over 100,000 school districts. But in a highly decentralized system like this, the only way to advocate for change is to launch a crusade of some kind, to seek support with promises of nirvana or with threats of damnation and brimstone. And most of my career has been devoted to trying to understand how American public education developed and why it has so often been the target of zealous reformers. Over the years, I've cultivated a skeptical stance towards the many varieties of utopianism and millenarianism and zealotry and ardor that have so often been associated with school reform. And tonight, I intend to bring a measure of skepticism to our current era of school reform. I should also warn you that I'm really practicing out some ideas that are going to form the basis of a book that I'm just starting. Well, I published a book in the year 2000 called Left Back that attempted to describe the history of American schools in the 20th century. The book traces the rise and fall of various school reform movements. In a superficial skim, I counted at least 20 school reform movements in that century, although there were probably many more. There was the progressive education movement and the efficiency movement and the activity movement and the vocational education movement and the industrial education movement and the scientific movement and the life adjustment movement and the back to basics movement, the whole language movement, and I could go on and on. Each movement thought that it had the answer, the one answer that would make the schools successful. And in looking at this ongoing parade of school reform movements, I found that what we now call reform is usually a rehash of some idea that was tried and failed a long time ago. I'm always amused to open up the daily newspaper or look on the internet and find a story about a school that was doing exactly what was done at the University of Missouri Elementary School in 1905. But it comes back again and again. Reform has been the one constant in the life of our schools for the last 100 years. What the public schools have not had is stability, coherence, and clarity of goals. The earliest reforms began a century ago when school reformers reacted with great anxiety to the huge influx of immigrants from Europe. The immigrants said that the public schools were woefully unprepared for these children because the schools offered only book learning, which was a bad thing. Using the rhetoric of egalitarianism and democracy, the reformers demanded industrial and vocational education for the newcomers. It was a waste of time, they said, to teach such children subjects like history and literature and science. They didn't need literature. They needed just enough English to write a job application. They didn't need history. They needed just enough social studies to understand their place in the social order. They needed only the science and math that would enable them to function well in daily life as factory workers or farm laborers or housewives. Such thinking is deeply elitist, as I argued, because it establishes different educational goals for the children of different classes, not equal educational opportunity for all, but differential opportunity based on the occupation of one's parents. Today, we're again in the throes of school reform. It seems that every day, there's yet another study or report demanding a radical overhaul of the public schools. And every day, the media tells us about school districts that have enacted major reforms in hopes of improving student achievement or raising graduation rates. There are plenty of signs that the schools need improvement. American students get mediocre scores on international tests of mathematics and science. Students' knowledge of history and literature is spotty at best. Tests of geography produce dismal results. About a third of the students who enter higher education, and in some states, about as many as half of all college students who enter public higher education, need remediation and basic skills that they should have mastered in high school or even in junior high school. Society as a whole pays the cost of inadequate education. A substantial portion of the general public embraces unfounded ideas about science and politics. Surprising numbers of people, sometimes as many as a third or even more, endorse bizarre conspiracy theories about Pearl Harbor, the Holocaust, extraterrestrials, the Kennedy assassination, 9/11, AIDS, and other controversial subjects. Presumably, if they were better educated, if they had learned to think and reason rigorously, there would be fewer people willing to see sinister, invisible forces behind every tragedy or unexplained event. The current era of school reform began with a federal report in 1983 called A Nation at Risk. The report received wide public attention, probably sold and given away more copies of that report than any government education report ever, probably got more attention than any other education document of the 20th century. It was a reaction to the sweeping reforms of the 1960s and the 1970s, when most school districts reduced their high school graduation requirements and most colleges lowered their entrance requirements. These changes by school districts and by colleges were an effort to placate student rebels who demanded more freedom to direct their own education. In the 1970s, non-academic electives proliferated in high schools, while the number of students taking advanced courses in foreign languages plummeted. Some districts offered academic credit for courses such as cheerleading, student government, and mass media. In California in the early 1980s, the only statewide requirement for high school graduation was 2 years of physical education. Studies by the U.S. Department of Education at that time found that more than 40% of all high school students, a plurality, were enrolled in the general track, which was neither academic nor vocational, and in the general track, they got credit towards graduation for courses such as typing, driver education, homemaking, glee club, cultural awareness, food for singles. Nation at Risk called for a restoration of graduation requirements for all students, as well as better educated and better paid teachers. The report focused on the content of schooling. It urged that all high school students, no matter what their likely occupational future, should be expected to take 4 years of English, 3 years of math, science, and social studies. And it maintained that a better educated public would benefit all of us in many ways, socially, economically, and culturally. Today, most education experts consider Nation at Risk to be the start of the current reform era. If they like the current emphasis on testing, accountability, and choice, they hail Nation at Risk as the founding document of those reforms. If they hate the emphasis on testing, accountability, and choice, as many educators do, they blame Nation at Risk for overstating the problems of the schools and blaming the schools for the nation's economic woes. Well, I don't agree with either line of thinking. Nation at Risk called on the American education establishment to emphasize content, to make sure that every student received a solid education in the major academic disciplines, and to make better use of instructional time by assigning homework or by extending the school day or the school year. Nation at Risk actually said very little about testing and accountability. I was rereading it today on the way to Amherst and found about three lines dealing with testing and accountability in a report of some 30 or 40 pages. It said nothing at all about choice, not a single word. So here we are 25 years later with our public schools in the grip of a powerful reform movement that pays no attention at all to content and that focuses relentlessly on testing, accountability, and choice as the primary levers to improve our public schools. Today, the leading edge of school reform is the federal law called No Child Left Behind. NCLB, as it is referred to in common parlance, embodies all the current reform ideas of testing, accountability, and choice. When it was adopted by Congress in late 2001, NCLB enjoyed broad bipartisan support. Leading congressional Democrats, including Senator Ted Kennedy, Massachusetts, and Congressman George Miller, California, each of them the most prominent Democrat on education issues in their respective House of Congress, helped draft the legislation and stood proudly with President George Bush when he signed it into law in January of 2002. The law mandates that every school district must test every student annually in reading and math from grade 3 through 8, and once again in high school. To refuse to comply is to risk losing federal education funding, which no district wants to do. Every state can set its own standards, choose its own test, and define proficiency as it wishes. Every district is required to disaggregate student test scores by race, ethnicity, low-income status, English language proficiency, and disability status. All students, the law says, will be proficient in reading and math by the year 2014. All students must be on track to meet this target to make what is called AYP, which stands for Annual Yearly Progress, for every disaggregated group. If any group in a school fails to advance towards the goal of 100% proficiency by 2014 for 2 years in a row, the school will be identified publicly as a failing school, or, in education speak, a school in need of improvement, a SINI school, S-I-N-I. The law lists what's called a cascade of sanctions for schools that fail to meet their goals for any group of students. All students in a school that is identified as SINI, in need of improvement, must be given the choice to attend a different public school. The students must be given free after-school tutoring. The school staff may be fired in whole or in part. The school may be restructured or closed. The school may be turned into a charter school or turned over to private management. The school may be taken over by the state. Now, none of these sanctions is based on experience or research. They're nothing more than reflections of the ideas that were popular among Democratic and Republican members of Congress and their staffs and the Beltway think tanks in 2001 when the law was drafted. For instance, there's not a single example of a school or a school district that was taken over by a state and that has gotten better. NCLB has turned the agenda of testing, accountability, and choice into the National Reform Program. Is it working? Well, at one level, it can never work. The law sets a goal that is beyond reach. There's no way that every student in every school will be proficient by the year 2014 unless proficiency is redefined to mean minimal literacy and minimal numeracy. This is a goal that has never been achieved in any school district, in any state, or in any nation, and it will not be achieved in the next 6 years. I think it is safe to predict. Currently, there are 10,000 schools that have failed to make annual yearly progress goals. As we get closer to the magical year, 2014, this number will continue to grow, with no help in sight other than to privatize schools, charterize schools, close schools, and in a variety of other ways, dismantle public education. Consider the effects of this regime. In response to the law, public schools across the nation are now immersed in what I would call a frenzy of testing to avoid the stigma of being publicly labeled a school in need of improvement, aka failing school. Many classroom hours that might have been devoted to instruction in science, history, literature, and the arts are instead devoted to preparing to take the next round of state tests. In New York City, where I live, the school year is organized around testing. Students in grades 3 through 8 take a monthly interim test to get ready for the state test. And in between the interim test, they spend an hour or two every day preparing for test taking. Quite literally, their education is being sacrificed to testing. The tests have been turned into some sort of magical device that can be used to rate and evaluate not only students, but their teachers and principals as well. Some districts and states are paying bonuses to teachers and principals who are able to produce higher test scores. Woe to the educator who cannot boast higher test scores. A few districts, New York City being one of them, are actually paying students to get higher test scores. Little children are taking home checks for $30, $32, $34, and 50 cents to recognize their higher scores. We know from the work of social psychologist Edward Deci that paying students to perform will increase their motivation temporarily, but when the rewards stop, the motivation stops also. Such payments, in fact, decrease the goal of education, which is to promote self-discipline, intrinsic motivation, and love of learning for its own sake. But no matter, we are in an era where the only thing that matters are results without regard to how they're achieved. Today we have a phenomenon in which the great majority of states report a steady and sometimes dramatic rise in test scores in reading and math. Yet when the federal government administers its independent test every other year, which are called NAEP, for the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the scores reported by NAEP for the states are either flat or show only small gains. What we're seeing is widespread grade inflation of the state test scores, which are artificially boosted to meet the federal mandates, to climb closer to that elusive goal of 100% proficiency, and to give the false impression of continuous improvement. Now, be it noted, Massachusetts is one of the rare exceptions to the national scene. Massachusetts, early on, long before No Child Left Behind, adopted the best set of curriculum standards in the nation and based the MCAS on its curriculum standards. Massachusetts also set entry standards for new teachers who are expected to know what they will teach, which may seem like a revolutionary idea. Massachusetts now leads the nation on the federal test in every category. But Massachusetts is an exception. It is not typical of what is happening in the rest of the nation. Most other states have sought to meet the testing and accountability requirements of NCLB by emphasizing testing, rewards for higher scores, and punishments for not getting higher scores. So now the goals of schooling are presumably to be attained by sanctions and incentives. In fact, the theory and practice of the No Child Left Behind law, as we've learned these past 6 years, has everything to do with producing higher test scores and nothing at all to do with generating better education. There are a limited number of hours in each school week. To the extent that more time is set aside for testing and prepping for tests, less time is available for studying history, geography, the arts, literature, civics, and other non-tested subjects. Of what value is an education that minimizes the time available for everything but basic skills? Now, don't get me wrong, basic skills are necessary, but they are by no means sufficient. After these years of NCLB, we can now look at the NAEP scores and see that this overwhelming concentration on basic skills has not paid off, even in basic skills acquisition. In fourth grade reading, the gains registered before the law was passed in the period from 2000 to 2002 were larger than those posted after the law was enacted. The same is true in mathematics. In eighth grade reading, there has been no improvement at all for the past 20 years. Some say that the gains are limited because we're not spending enough money. But I say that the gains are limited because we don't have the right goals. The goal I suggest should be the one contained in A Nation at Risk 25 years ago, to assure that every child has the opportunity to study a full, coherent, and balanced program of studies encompassing the full range of the liberal arts and sciences. What we lack then and what we lack now is a meaningful curriculum of studies which prioritizes knowledge and learning and which values broadened understanding, the growth of imaginative powers, and the cultivation of reasoned, logical thinking. What happened in the drafting of NCLB is similar to what has happened to the schools in general. They have been captured, the schools have been captured, as the language of NCLB was, by the practices and the language of management. The linguistic revolution in education has been sweeping, astonishing, really. Educators once debated curriculum and pedagogy. Now they talk about benchmarks, performance indicators, annual yearly progress, targets, database decision-making, delivery systems, providers, CMOs and EMOs. Providers, by the way, are schools. And there are some districts where principals are being encouraged to think of themselves as CEOs. I mean, it just gets worse and worse as you dig deeper into how the language has changed. Businesses worry about making their quarterly numbers, that is, their profit. Schools now worry about making their numbers, that is, their test score gains. There's a difference, however. When a business makes its numbers, it's profitable. A school can produce test score gains, yet at the same time be educationally bankrupt. By educationally bankrupt, I mean that its students may be completely ignorant of history, geography, science, current events, the arts, and so on. Now that many districts are hiring non-educators as superintendents, the danger increases that these lawyers, business leaders, social workers, admirals, and generals will seek to prove their success strictly by the numbers. The nature of their situation demands that they produce the numbers. They were hired to produce the numbers. Having no education experience, by and large, they have no educational ideas. They will not understand that higher test scores are not necessarily the same as better education. They may or may not realize that schools can jerry-rig higher scores by excluding low-performing students from the testing, by holding back low-performing students from the grade that's to be tested, by relentlessly practicing for tests that has no relationship to anything of educational or vocational significance. In New York City, the local authorities say that students did well on the state test because they practiced for it, but they did poorly on the federal test because they didn't practice for it. I suppose that in the future they will not be able to read anything or write anything unless it was on the state test. That is educational malpractice. What employer or college will want students who know and can do only what was on the test? Inappropriate application of the business model into the world of education has stimulated practices based on the free market. It may be that the free market leads people to build a better mousetrap, but there's no evidence that a free market in education leads to the creation of a better school system for all. The idea of a free market is exemplified by various choice programs, such as vouchers and charter schools. Just as NCLB is predicated on the belief that children get smarter if they're tested regularly, choice is based on the belief that all schools will get better if they're compelled to compete for students. I will not discuss vouchers because legal challenges have limited them to only a few districts, Milwaukee, Cleveland, and the District of Columbia, and their impact has been minimal, even in those districts. Is choice a valuable strategy for school improvement? Certainly there are a lot of organizations and foundations and think tanks that support choice and see it as the sine qua non of school reform. I have been associated with some of them, still am associated with some of them, and I know very well the arguments for choice. Not all the evidence is in on this question, so I will proceed with caution. My hunch is that choice benefits the ablest students by allowing them to enroll in a school that has a selection mechanism. The parents who are most committed and most involved are the ones who will seek alternatives. Their hope, and sometimes the reality, is that they will get a private school education paid for with public tax dollars. When charter schools were evaluated, it is clear that there is a very wide range of quality among them. Some of them are undeniably successful, and some of them are undeniably as bad as the worst public school. Some offer a curriculum comparable to an elite private school, while others are mismanaged and undeserving of public dollars, and public officials have been all too slow to close down some of those that are at the bottom of the scale. The promoters of charter schools insist that the regular district schools will learn from their experiences, but thus far this has not happened. I am not aware of district schools that have copied the methods, hours, or curriculum of successful charter schools. In the past, I've supported choice in charter schools, hoping that they would spur the creation of exemplary schools with a deep and rich curriculum, and that their success would be widely noted and influential. As I said, there are undoubtedly some great charter schools, but their numbers are few. What concerns me is the overall effect of charters on public education. It seems to me, and I hope I'm wrong, that what they are doing is draining away the most motivated students and parents from the regular schools. They're also helping to kill off inner-city Catholic schools, which have been incredibly effective for the children of poor and working-class families, by offering a free alternative. In city after city, we see the replacement of successful Catholic schools by unknown and unproven charter schools because poor parents can't afford the tuition of the Catholic school and need a free alternative. When I step back and think about the future, I ask myself, where did choice strategies lead us? On their present course, they will further deplete the resources and the energy of the regular public schools. To the extent that they thrive, I fear that they will skim the best students and leave the remainder for the regular public schools. It seems to me that there is a role for the charter schools that would strengthen public education. I think that they should be the schools that accept the students who can't make it in regular public schools, the ones who are bored and restless and turned off by school, the ones who are resistant to learning in the traditional classroom, and the ones who make it impossible for everyone else to learn. Charters have the freedom to innovate, to do what no one else is doing. They are free of the customary rules and regulations and constraints. Why shouldn't they be the laboratories for American education? Why don't they take on the challenge of unmotivated students and show what they can do to engage them in their education? I know that many charter operators don't want to hear this. They prefer to hold a lottery among families and students who want to be accepted. They want kids who apply, not kids who are reluctant learners who don't want to go to school. But if charter is going to strengthen public education, they should be lighthouses for innovation, not escape hatches for the nimblest. The free market, I think, will not help public education, nor will competition and choice. The workings of the free market guarantee that there will be winners and losers. As students sort themselves in the schools of choice, some of these schools will be superior, others will be abysmal. Some public schools will remain rock solid, and others will get worse. And as this mechanism becomes routinized, the gaps between the best educated and the worst educated will grow larger. But our goal is not to educate some while warehousing others. Our goal is to educate everyone, and the free market model will not move us towards that goal, I fear. The bottom line question is whether our nation wants to have a public education system that works for all children. Some education theorists imagine a future in which all schools operate entirely in a choice system. There would be a broad diversity of schools, most of them privately managed by for-profit or non-profit organizations. Some remnant of public education would remain, but only for those who have not chosen a school from the broad menu of options. One can envision a scenario in which the public schools are the schools of last resort, the schools that are left with the kids that no other school wants, the schools that never made it, the children that never made a choice and whose families didn't make a choice and maybe didn't care enough to make a choice. This harkens back to the origins of public schools in big cities, when public schools in big cities were pauper schools. Let me explain why I think this would be a terrible idea. To begin with, I do not know of any modern nation that does not have a good public school system. Of course, there should be alternatives for those who want them. There should be vibrant religious schools for those who want a religious education. And there should be fine private schools where parents are willing to pay whatever the cost. But the system that serves the other 90% of our children should be reliable, sturdy, and effective. Our promise and our ideal of equal educational opportunity depend on having a good public school in every neighborhood, accessible to children from every background. We have not yet delivered on that promise, especially in urban areas, but we should not abandon the goal. We need a good public school in every neighborhood for the same reason that we need a good firehouse in every neighborhood. Access to good public services should not be a function of one's income or one's ambition. To the extent that we dismantle or privatize or outsource public education, to that extent we will widen the social and economic gaps in our country, and to that extent we will lose the American dream of equal educational opportunity. What does public education need now? Many things. I believe it needs a strong, coherent national curriculum that guarantees that every child, no matter where he or she lives, gets equal educational opportunity and a rich education in the liberal arts and sciences. I believe it needs a safe, orderly, and respectful environment in every school. And it needs teachers who are well-educated. In recent years, many very bright and very talented young people have entered teaching in urban school districts. Most stay for only 2 years. But a few do become enthralled with the life of the classroom and remain to make a career of what was supposed to be only an interesting experience. I would like to encourage students from this region to consider a career in education. This is a career that will engage your intellectual passions while touching and changing, eventually, thousands of lives. The state and federal government, I would hope, would enact programs of college loan forgiveness for graduates who enter teaching, so that all the indebtedness incurred in getting a college degree would be paid off within a reasonable period of time, say at the rate of 1 year of college loans for every year of teaching. And I want to return to the beginning of my discussion. What we need in American education is, strangely enough, good education. What we need is a coherent, rich curriculum for all students, one that includes not only reading and math, but the other important parts of the liberal arts curriculum, history and literature, the arts, geography, civics, the sciences, foreign languages. I know that our decentralized system of education makes it difficult to enact a national curriculum, but the day may come, or so I hope, that we will recognize the necessity and the value of doing so. What we have now is not good education. Instead, we have a plethora of mutually reinforcing federal and state programs targeted solely on improving test scores and basic skills, but that is not good enough. Children become better readers when what they learn is consequential and connected and imaginative and exciting. Daily drilling and daily test prep produce parrot-like responses, not deep understanding and curiosity. Are we making progress? No, we are not making progress. Instead, we're focused solely on low-level attainments. Meanwhile, as we busy ourselves with these low-level goals, we neglect our most gifted students, and we fail to build the great education system that we need. So I would recommend to you that you turn your sustained attention to the reconstruction of our educational system. Think about how we as a nation can strengthen our curriculum, attract well-educated teachers, build a strong and energetic teaching profession, and restore our educational ideals. I hope you will not join a movement. Instead, put your shoulder to the wheel and recognize that the changes that are needed are possible, are common sense, and are, with a lot of hard work, within our reach. Thank you.